We're up to slide 5, and we need to talk about light, since we're talking about photosynthesis. And light is energy, but it's specifically electromagnetic energy. And electromagnetic energy has a lot of categories that you see listed here at the top, but it's all the same stuff. I'll tell you why it's different in a second, but electromagnetic energy has an electrical component and a magnetic component. That's why it's named that. That's beyond the scope of this course. But it has a duality of nature, light does, or electromagnetic energy does, which means that in some ways it acts as a wave, in some ways it acts as a particle. It has both of these properties at the same time. If you think of it as a particle, it's not a material particle. It doesn't have mass. But a single particle of light energy is called a photon. That's the particulate nature of light. If you think of it as a wave, and things that occur in waves have something called a wavelength, which is simply the distance from one part of the pattern to the next repeating part. It could be measured anywhere as long as it's repeating. And so a wavelength is a distance. And that is really the only thing that's different about these different categories of electromagnetic energy. It's all the same stuff. It's just differing in its wavelength. So this is a huge range of wavelengths that we're seeing here, from a tiny fraction of a nanometer, much smaller than an atom, to thousands of meters. And the very long wavelengths are invisible to us. It's light. Radio waves are light. The things that make radios work are passing through our body all the time. We just can't detect it because the wavelength's too long for that kind of light to interact with the pigments in our eyeballs. Get a little bit shorter, it's still invisible. That's microwaves, the stuff that heats your food in an oven and that's how your cell phone works. A little bit shorter is infrared, so called because it's just a little bit too long to see by humans. Because if you go, it means below red. The longest wavelength that we can see gives us the sensation of redness. And so this humanly visible portion that you see here is really just a tiny sliver of the overall electromagnetic spectrum. And that's where you have Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, all the possible colors are not really a property of the light. The light is not colored. Color is an event that occurs in the human brain when light of certain wavelengths cause a reaction in the pigments in the eyeballs, and that sends message to the brain. The color sensation happens in the brain. And that only occurs for this narrow range of wavelengths. When you get shorter than the shortest one we're capable of seeing, which is indigo, or violet, really, then we call that ultraviolet light, just above violet. By the way, when you get a shorter wavelength, you increase the energy, which is why when we go on to the left of the visible stuff on these categories, that becomes increasingly more dangerous. UV light causes cancer, which is why you should minimize sun exposure. Even more dangerous are x-rays, which is why you don't get x-rays every day, right? They limit the amount of x-rays that your body's given. And then much more dangerous than that are gamma rays, which thankfully for us are filtered out before they hit Earth. Otherwise, it would kill us. But this is all the same stuff. It's electromagnetic energy, and humans are only sensitive to this small fraction. This is a chapter on photosynthesis, though. So why am I talking about humanly visible light? Well, by coincidence, photosynthetic organisms use pretty much the same range of light that we use for vision. But it also has to do with why things look the way they do. So if we go to 6, we're looking at a chloroplast here, and you're used to photosynthetic organisms like plants looking green, at least part of the plant does, like the leaves, well, once again, it's not the plant that's green. The greenness is occurring in your brain if green wavelength light or wavelength corresponding to greenness is the kind of light that hits your eye. Sunlight is a mixture of all wavelengths and therefore all colors. And when that white light hits a plant, or hits specifically the thylakoids of a plant, which are where the chlorophyll molecules are located, the chlorophyll absorbs photons in the red and blue ranges. Those photons, when they're absorbed, don't exist anymore, right? We talked about that. So the green does not get absorbed. Instead, it gets reflected, which is why that's the only kind of light that reaches our eye, and that's what makes the plants look green to us. But it's important that plants are absorbing these red range and blue range photons, because if they didn't absorb photons, then the light wouldn't be delivering energy to the plant. That's what has to happen in photosynthesis for there to be a transduction of energy from sunlight or electromagnetic form to chemical form. Plants have to store energy that was originally in sunlight, or light, doesn't have to come from the sun, store that energy that was in light in the form of chemicals that we'll look at in a minute. So let's look at 7. We have three different ways of describing the same thing here. On the top is a graph that graphs three different absorption spectra, which is just the plural of spectrum. This is three graphs in one. Each trace could be its own graph. But notice on the x-axis we have wavelength, which to us corresponds to colors, wavelength of the light, and an absorption spectrum plots absorption versus wavelength. So how well a pigment absorbs light for the given wavelengths. And pigments, by the way, are simply substances that absorb photons. Okay? Well, plants and other photosynthetic organisms use different pigments to absorb their photons, but the principal photosynthetic pigment, or pigment category, is called chlorophyll, a word that really means green leaf. Chloro means green and phyll means leaf. But chlorophyll comes in two major varieties, chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B, which is why they have their own traces here. And notice they absorb a little bit differently from each other. Chlorophyll A absorbs very well in the extremes, but not well at all in the green range, which is why the green gets reflected to us. It doesn't get absorbed by the plant. Chlorophyll B also absorbs well in the extremes, but not, you know, they peak at different places. And then in addition to chlorophylls, there are collectively different pigments that are called accessory pigments. And the chief accessory pigment in plants are carotenoids. Well, when you have all three of these major pigments, chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B, and carotenoids, each with its own absorption spectrum, then it gives the plant a wide range of wavelengths that can be usefully absorbed. Maximizes the effectiveness, in other words, of catching the light. The action spectrum in B has the same shape. It's high at the ends and low in the green range. But this is a graph that is generated by plotting rate of photosynthesis versus wavelength. What this shows you is that you don't want to give a plant green light only. If you give it a green light, it's going to starve because it can't absorb that light very well and therefore can't make its food, which is what photosynthesis does. But if you give it blue or red or both, it'll do well. Same thing is shown on the bottom, except that this one involves a microscopic a little case that is sealed, airtight, And on a piece of glass that's in there, there is a filamentous alga that's placed. And alga is photosynthetic. But it's sealed, so there's no oxygen available. But in addition to the alga, you have bacteria growing possibly on the alga, and these bacteria are aerobic, so they require oxygen, or they won't grow. And what you see is that they build up at the blue and red ends because light is being absorbed by the alga at those lights, and therefore it's conducting photosynthesis, and therefore spitting out O2, which is a byproduct of photosynthesis, and that allows the bacteria to grow there. But they don't grow where it's green because there's no O2 being emitted there. Let's take a closer look at chlorophyll in 8. Now, you don't have to memorize this structural formula, but what you see here is a chlorophyll molecule. And this could represent either A, chlorophyll A, or chlorophyll B, because the only difference is this little box. If it's a CH3, as it is right here, then it's chlorophyll A. If it's CHO instead, with all the rest the same, it's chlorophyll B. Not much of a difference between them, but it's enough to make a difference as to what kind of light gets optimally absorbed by these two different pigments. The business end of a chlorophyll molecule, so to speak, as far as absorbing photons is concerned, is what's highlighted in green here. This whole molecule is embedded in the thylakoid membrane of a chloroplast. The membrane's not shown here. But the green part is what does the absorbing, which allows the energy to be transferred from light to the plant. You have various atoms here, a lot of carbons, hydrogens, oxygens, some nitrogens, magnesium, and so on. But then notice this tail. There are no atoms listed here, but remember the shorthand that biochemistry uses. If you see a bend with nothing labeled, then that is a carbon. You have to assume that's a carbon and enough hydrogens to satisfy the valence. So from here downward, this is nothing but carbons and hydrogens, even though they're not spelled with letters. So, in other words, this tail is a hydrocarbon tail. And that's important because that's what keeps this molecule embedded in the thylakoid membrane. Keep in mind that hydrocarbons are nonpolar because carbon and hydrogen, the things they're made of, have equal electronegativities. And that's what anchors it in the membrane because this nonpolar hydrocarbon tail has no problem being around the nonpolar tails of the phospholipids in the bilayer. Okay, so they're both important parts, but the green part is what does the actual absorbing of photons. Okay, now to 9. Pigments, as I said, are substances or molecules that absorb photons. And I think I mentioned before, but it's important, so I'll re-mention it. When a photon gets absorbed, if it does, it no longer exists. Absorption of a photon destroys that photon. But of course, you already know from the first law of thermodynamics that energy can't be destroyed. The photon is carrying energy. But when the photon gets destroyed, the energy doesn't, of course. The energy goes into the photon, to the pigment. This is important for photosynthesis. But photosynthesis is not the only pigments. Pigments are in paints, all kinds of things, right? Well, when the energy gets delivered from a photon that has been destroyed by being absorbed, that energy goes into exciting the pigment. What I mean by excite is that an electron of that pigment molecule will be sent up at least one energy level. And keep in mind how energy levels are arranged. The lowest energy level, shell 1, is closest to the nucleus, right? And then they go up from there. Higher energy levels are associated with higher G values. So that's where the energy goes when the photon gets destroyed. It takes energy to put an electron up an energy level or more. That's a very unstable situation, though. Remember, higher the G is, the more unstable the system is. Electrons in any given atom want to occupy the lowest energy level they can. And when they do under normal circumstances. They can't all be in energy level 1 because there's only so many electrons allowed in there. But any given electron is in the lowest energy level it can occupy under normal circumstances. Well, when a photon strikes a pigment and the pigment gets excited, an electron goes up an energy level, but it wants to come back down immediately. And usually it will. Well, when an electron goes down an energy level, energy is lost. But of course, it's not destroyed, right? Therefore, what happens is a process called fluorescence. Fluorescence creates a brand new photon. The original photon's no longer there because it got absorbed. When the electron comes back down, to make up for the energy it's losing, a brand new photon gets created to carry that energy away. And so a fluorescing material is shining its own light that it's creating. This is why fluorescent paints look so bright. You know, like fluorescent paint in a speed limit sign. If you're driving far enough away from a city that it's dark, truly dark, the only light is your headlight, it will look like the speed limit sign is bright as hell. Well, it's not just because it's reflecting light, your headlight. Your headlight is, the light from your headlight is actually being destroyed when it hits the sign. It's exciting those fluorescent paint molecules, and then they are immediately creating new photons and shining those into your eyes. That's why it looks so bright. It is lit up. Well, that would be a completely worthless thing if it happened in plants, because the whole idea for photosynthesis is to capture the energy. And when a pigment fluoresces, it's just sending that energy away as new photons. There would be no harnessing of the light energy if chlorophyll and other photosynthetic pigments fluoresced. They do fluoresce, though, if you simply have isolated or just a suspension of liquid with a bunch of chlorophyll molecules in them. You shine light on that, it will glow, it will fluoresce. But that would be worthless for a plant. It doesn't happen, fluorescence does not happen in a plant, though, a living plant, because the pigment molecules are not just on their own. They are complexed with a bunch of proteins in a special way that prevents fluorescence. And therefore allows the light to actually stay with the plant. I mean, the energy from the light to stay with the plant. Well, this involves slide 10. The membrane we're looking at in slide 10 is the thylakoid membrane, as it's labeled. So this is not only within the chloroplast, but it's the membrane of one of those coin-looking sacs, a thylakoid. It's all one membrane, but it looks like it's a separate coins. They're all connected. So it's an elaborately folded membrane, the thylakoid membrane. And this is just a tiny piece of it. We're just looking at one photosystem here, the thing that looks like a bell pepper cut in half, is one photosystem. And a photosystem is a complex of pigment molecules, including chlorophylls and carotenoids. But those are all represented by the green dots. Those pigment molecules are complexed with a bunch of proteins, which are represented by the purple background. But there's two major sections or pieces to a single photosystem. And this one's cut in half so you can see the interior. But the purpleness would wrap all the way around. In the middle, the core of this in lavender, or whatever this blueness is the so-called reaction center complex, which is also proteins and a special pair of chlorophyll molecules. And then wrapped around that are several different, purple in this cartoon, light harvesting complexes, also made up of proteins and chlorophylls. But that's what gives it its bell pepper appearance. And the way that these chlorophylls and other pigment molecules are complexed with the proteins is what disallows fluorescence, which would be wasteful, as I said. So what happens is that a photon, well, there's trillions and trillions of photons, even in a faint ray of light. Most of those just either pass through or get reflected off. They're not lucky enough to hit a pigment. But a bunch of them still do hit pigments because there's just so many photons. It doesn't have to be this pigment molecule, but this photon is showing hitting this one. Could have been any of them. And therefore, since it's light of the right wavelength, this pigment molecule will absorb that photon. That photon's no longer there. But instead of fluorescing like a chlorophyll would if it were on its own, it sends the energy of its excitation to a neighboring chlorophyll without actually creating a photon, without fluorescing. And it's also beyond the scope of this course to explain how this happens. I can just tell you the name of what happens, which is called resonance energy transfer. So resonance energy transfer is what prevents fluorescence and therefore saves the energy for the plant. Okay, so the black arrows here represent resonance energy transfer. This one gets excited and it sends that excitation to another one, which then sends its excitation to the next and so on. It's bouncing around from pigment to pigment. Eventually, the excitation will reach the special pair of chlorophylls that are in the reaction center complex in the middle of the photosystem. And that special pair of chlorophylls not only gets excited, it gets, in a sense, super excited. The electron not only goes up in energy level, it actually leaves the entire molecule. That's what's represented by the yellow arrow with the E minus, which is an electron. In other words, it ionizes it because it's losing an electron. The electron, of course, is not destroyed. It's just no longer associated with this chlorophyll. So something is receiving this electron when it's being lost. The thing that receives the electron that's lost from the chlorophyll is represented by the square here, and that is the so-called primary electron acceptor of the photosystem. When this happens, how would you describe what's happening to the primary electron acceptor, chemically speaking? It's getting reduced. In other words, a photosystem operates for a light-driven redox reaction in which this special pair of chlorophyll gets oxidized and the primary electron acceptor gets reduced. Compare this to redox reactions that we studied in the last chapter. Fuels get oxidized, right, so that we can reduce coenzymes, which are now carrying energy. Well, this primary electron acceptor is getting reduced, and it's therefore carrying some of the energy that was in the light. Some of it got lost as heat, of course. But this is important in capturing the light so that it can do some work for the plant eventually. The primary electron acceptor does not hang on to the electron very long, as we'll see. But it has it at the moment because it's been reduced. That's basically how a photosystem works. Now, there's trillions and trillions of copies of photosystems. This is just one. Slide 11 shows you two categories of photosystems. All photosystems are more or less the same, but they're not. There's two categories. So there's trillions and trillions of copies of each of these two categories. And they are called photosystem 1 and photosystem 2, but it's a confusing nomenclature because the first one to operate here, shown on the left, is called photosystem 2, and the second one is called photosystem 1. Now, you would think that's a stupid way of numbering, and it would be if it weren't for just an accident that happened. These were not named for the order in which they operate. they're named for the order in which they were discovered by humans. So we discovered photosystem one first and called it photosystem one. But it actually is the second one to operate in this set of materials here. The overall set of things that we're looking at in this slide make up the or perform, I should say, the first part of photosynthesis. Do you remember what the first part of photosynthesis is called? Well, then you're not ready for the test. The first part of photosynthesis is called the light-dependent reactions. And the light-dependent reactions require four things, all of which are shown here. Now, there's trillions of copies of all these four things in this arrangement. This is just one functional unit. But it involves two photosystems, photosystem 2 and photosystem 1, plus an electron transport chain between photosystem 2 and photosystem 1, plus a shorter electron transport chain after photosystem 1. All four of those things together make up a functional unit that operate for the light-dependent reactions. And it's not shown here, but all of this stuff is embedded in the thylakoid membrane along with trillions of other copies of the same set. Okay, let's see how this works. Photosystem 2, the first one, is being excited because a lucky photon of the right wavelength strikes one of these pigment molecules. Just as I talked about before, you have resonance energy transfer from one pigment molecule to the next. Eventually, the special pair in the reaction center complex gets super excited and loses its electron. That electron reduces the primary electron acceptor, but as I said in the last slide, it doesn't hang on to the electron very long. It immediately dumps that electron off to the first member of the chain that's between the two photosystems. Notice it's doing the same exact thing that a reduced coenzyme was doing in cellular respiration. They drove to the electron transport chains in the mitochondria, right? This thing is dumping its electron off to an electron transport chain as well. And even though the chain here is not identical chemically, as far as the members are concerned, to the one that operates in a mitochondrion, it's doing exactly the same job. Not all the details are shown here, but you should have already studied this from the previous chapter. When electrons get transferred down the chain, energy gets released, and that release of energy powers the pumping of protons. It's just now it's pumping it through the thylakoid membrane since we're in a different organelle. And that pumping of protons creates a gradient, which is a form of stored energy, that causes protons to want to diffuse back in to where they came from through the membrane. And the only place in the membrane they're allowed to do that are through the ATP synthase molecules that are also in that membrane, just like in a mitochondrion. And that spins the ATP synthase rotors with respect to the stators, and that phosphorylates ADP to make ATP. That's why you have ATP coming out here. All right? Now, hopefully you remember from where we left off last time that the Calvin cycle, which is part two of photosynthesis, can't do its job of producing sugar without two sources of chemical energy. It requires ATP, and this is where the ATP for the Calvin cycle gets produced. It is storing energy that used to be in the sunlight that got absorbed. Okay. Now, the same thing is happening in photosystem 1. It's getting excited. Resonance energy transfer to the reaction center complex, special pair. It loses its electron, and that electron gets delivered by the primary electron acceptor to this second, shorter electron transport chain. That shorter chain does not pump any protons. Instead, it just delivers the electrons along with protons that are in solution to an empty taxi. But the fleet of taxis that are used for photosynthesis, which are NADP, not NAD. That's why you have an empty NADP plus coming in here, receiving electrons and protons to become NADPH. All right? So that's the other form of chemical energy that the Calvin cycle requires. The first chain produces ATP. The second chain produces reduced coenzymes in the form of NADPH. Both of the exactly the things that the Calvin cycle requires. Okay, now, when either of these two photosystems, special pair in the reaction center complex, get oxidized, when they lose their electron, that makes it very unstable. These chlorophylls want an electron back immediately. Now, they don't care whether it's the same electron, which it's not going to be, because all electrons are the same, but they need an electron back. Well, in the second photosystem, which is photosystem one, the electron that's lost by these pair of chlorophylls gets immediately replaced by an electron that's coming down the first chain between the two photosystems. Okay? Loses one and gets one back from the chain. But the first photosystem, which is photosystem two, replaces it a little bit differently. This one loses an electron, wants one back immediately, but the source of replacement for that electron is water. Remember that water is an input into photosynthesis, right? Plants need water. Well, water is really just a source of electrons and protons, and those come from hydrogen, which is in water. So what happens in photosystem one is that water gets enzymatically split into oxygen and hydrogen. And then the hydrogen gets split into electrons and protons. Now compare this to what happened with the oxidation of fuel in the previous chapter. Hydrogen was really the source of energy in the form of electrons and protons, right? We pick hydrogens off of the fuel, and then we deliver those electrons and protons to coenzymes. Here we're picking water, we're picking hydrogen off of water for the sake of providing electrons and protons. The protons get pumped, the electrons get transferred. That's the hydrogen. But when you remove the hydrogen from water, what you have left as a waste product from the viewpoint of photosynthesis is oxygen. This is why oxygen comes out. It's a product in the summary reaction for photosynthesis. Okay, the oxygen produced by photosynthesis comes from water that is put into the situation. Okay, now, just to give you a cartoon of this whole thing, in case that helps you, I don't know whether it will, slide 12 is here. This just is a cartoon analogy of what's happening with these photosystems and electron transport chains. So the photon is providing the force, like this hammer, providing the energy to excite the electron, send it uphill. This is the primary electron acceptor for photosystem 2. She delivers the electron to the chain, which is like a downhill slope, turning a mill that makes ATP. That electron replaces one that's being lost by this photon hammer, and the electron that's lost here goes into reducing NADP plus into NADPH. So the sunlight is no longer there, the sunlight that got absorbed, but the energy from the sunlight is now in the chemical form of ATP and NADPH. 13 now. Everything that I've described in slide 11, with both chains working and both photosystems working, is called non-cyclic electron flow. And that's to distinguish it from another possibility, which is shown here, and it's called cyclic electron flow. Now, any set of photo systems and chains, because there's, like I said, millions and millions of copies of these, any individual set of two photo systems and two chains can operate in either mode. So there aren't ones that are dedicated to cyclic and ones that are dedicated to non-cyclic. Any set can go back and forth between operating via non-cyclic electron flow, which we've already talked about, or cyclic electron flow, which is shown here, as the need dictates. The reason this is called non-cyclic electron flow is that in the second photosystem, the primary electron acceptor does not deliver its electron to the shorter second chain. Instead, it puts that electron into the first chain again for a second ride through. That's why it's a cycle, right? And since this second chain is not being used in cyclic electron flow, that means no NADPH is being produced. That's why it's dim here. But since the electron goes back through the first chain, that first chain is the only one operating, and therefore ATP gets produced. In other words, cyclic electron flow produces ATP, but not NADPH. Non-cyclic electron flow produces both. The reason that these sets of photosystems and chains go back and forth between these two modes is that non-cyclic electron flow not only produces both NADPH and ATP, but it produces them in equal amounts. It produces them in a one-to-one ratio. Well, I've told you that the Calvin cycle requires both ATP and NADPH, but not equal amounts. The Calvin cycle requires more ATP than it does NADPH. It requires it in a 3-to-2 ratio. For every 2 NADPHs, it needs 3 ATPs, it being the Calvin cycle, which we're going to look at next. Okay? So if all you did is run non-cyclic electron flow, you could look at it as two ways it's wrong. Either way, either of two ways it's wrong. You're either not making enough ATP or you're making too much NADPH if you make it in a 1-to-1 ratio. So the photosynthetic organism needs to switch back and forth between the two modes, so it ends up being a 3-to-2 ratio. Well, the plant, of course, is not thinking about this or consciously knowing whether it should be in one mode or the other. So how does it happen? Well, it happens automatically because of something that's related to a problem I told you about for cellular respiration. Think back to when I talked about what happens if you're out of oxygen. When you're out of oxygen, which serves as the final electron acceptor in cellular respiration, remember, the electron transport chains will fill up, right? Because they don't have any oxygen to dump onto. And when the electron transport chains fill up, they can no longer receive any electrons from coenzymes, NADPH and FADH2, right? Therefore, eventually, all of the NADPH or NAD taxis and FAD taxis will be in use. They'll be full of passengers. If this happened in a city with taxis, no additional passengers could be picked up, right? Well, that's what happens here. Since NADPH is building up when you're making equal amounts of it compared to ATP, but it's not being used as much, eventually all the NADP taxis will be in the form of NADPH, full. There won't be any empty ones to come up here and pick up from this second chain. So the chain just fills up. That's what shuts it off. The chain can't dump to anywhere. Therefore, the only thing that the primary electron acceptor of this second photosystem can do is to put that electron through the first chain again. And that's why it'll temporarily switch to producing only ATP until that built-up available NADPH starts being used by the Calvin cycle, which will free up some taxis, and that will automatically switch the second chain back on. So in this way, by switching back and forth exactly the right 3-to-2 ratio of the two energy-carrying molecules will be produced for the Calvin cycle.
Is the energy phase inhibited then, or no? Is it not
It's not an allosteric inhibitor because it's not changing the shape of an enzyme. It's simply that it's required, just like NAD plus is required for glycolysis, which is why if you're not reoxidizing NADH by cellular respiration, you have to use fermentation to do the job. Okay, 14, just comparing electron transport for the purpose of producing ATP in both of the processes we've studied it in. Cellular respiration, which happens in a mitochondrion in a eukaryote, and photosynthesis, which happens in a chloroplast in a eukaryote. So the bottom square here could represent either of these. You would just have different names for the structures involved, but the same thing is happening. If you think of this as cellular respiration, then the light gray from where the protons get pumped, from where they get pumped, would be the mitochondrial matrix. The membrane would be the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. And the dark space would be the intermembrane space. That's where the protons get pumped to. Right? And then they want to diffuse back into the matrix. That causes the spinning of the rotors and the production of ATP. But if this is happening in a chloroplast, you just give different names. It's the same thing happening. The light gray is the stroma, which is, remember, the fluid that's inside the inner membrane but outside of the thylakoids. That's where the protons get pumped from, through the thylakoid membrane, into the dark gray thylakoid space inside the coin-like thylakoids. That's where they accumulate, and they want to diffuse back out of there back into the stroma, which they do, causing ATP to be produced. Exactly the same mechanism in these two. Fifteen puts it all together, meaning puts the whole light-dependent reactions together in more of an anatomical drawing, because you see the membrane here. So this is drastically out of scale. There would be room for a lot more copies of this, but only one copy of these structures is shown. One copy meaning two photosystems, two chains. But we've already talked about this. Let's just review it. Photons get absorbed by photosystem 2. That excites the reaction center, which loses its electron to the primary electron acceptor. It delivers to the chain. The electron trickles through the chain, which allows for the pumping of protons from the stroma into the thylakoid space. So the seafoam green is where there's a higher and higher concentration of protons. The photosystem 1 gets irradiated. It gets light strikes it and gets photons get absorbed. And that primary electron acceptor delivers its electron to the shorter chain to reduce NADP plus into NADPH, NH plus. Alright. I didn't mention the ATP synthase. The accumulation of protons in this green space, which is the thylakoid space, means they want to get out of there. They want to go down their gradient, but they're protons, so they can't get directly through the phospholipid bilayer because of their charge. The only place they're allowed through are the ATP synthase molecules, and that's what produces the ATP. Notice, though, that not only is this producing the two energetic requirements of the Calvin cycle, but they're being produced, NADPH and ATP, in the stroma, which is exactly where the Calvin cycle takes place. So it's perfect. Speaking of the Calvin cycle, it can also be called, remember, the light-independent reactions. You can call it either one of those. But the Calvin cycle, which is part two of photosynthesis, is really the part that accomplishes the goal of photosynthesis, which is to incorporate carbon that's originally in an inorganic molecule into an organic compound. What is that called? Carbon fixation. Right. That's the truly important thing that photosynthesis accomplishes, or chemosynthesis for that matter, but we're not studying that in this course. That's what producers and only producers do. Now, the organic compounds that are produced in this carbon fixation scheme are specifically sugars, and even more specifically, three carbon sugars. It's the Calvin cycle spits out, so to speak, not glucose directly, but a three-carbon sugar called glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, or G3P for short. If you look back at the details of glycolysis from the previous chapter, you'll see that G3P was one of the intermediates in that pathway as well. But it's not glucose, even though glucose is listed as the as one of the products in the summary reaction. Its Calvin cycle does not produce glucose directly. It produces G3P, but once you have G3P, you can combine them into glucose and other monosaccharides. And then you can, now that it's an organic compound, when it wasn't to start with, it was CO2. Once it's in organic form, then it can convert it to the other things that aren't even carbohydrates. So it can make amino acids and so on. Photosynthesis not only feeds the organism, it gives it sugar that can be used for fuel, but it also gives it raw materials for making all the other organic compounds that organisms use. All right, so we're looking at the Calvin cycle. It's a cycle, which means that the pathway, the string of reactions that it's made out of, wraps back onto itself. So the final reaction feeds the first reaction. And that happens at the top of the circle here, which you can think of as a start-finish line. This will happen only if you keep supplying it, of course, just like the citric acid cycle had to continuously be supplied with acetyl from acetyl coenzyme A. Here you have to continue to supply the citric acid, the Calvin cycle with carbon dioxide. That's the raw material that contains the carbon, but it's in inorganic form. All right. Well, let's look at what's receiving this CO2. It is a 5-carbon compound. Not all the other atoms are shown, but it's just represented for simplicity as 5-carbon atoms with 2 phosphates attached. This 5-carbon compound is called ribulose bisphosphate. Ribulose tells you that that's a sugar, right? A 5-carbon sugar. But it also has 2 phosphates. Bis means 2. So it's ribulose bisphosphate. It's a 5-carbon compound. And it receives CO2. CO2 is, of course, a 1-carbon compound. And when ribulose bisphosphate receives that additional carbon of CO2, it turns it into a 6-carbon compound, which doesn't last very long. It doesn't even get a name here. It's just called short-lived intermediate, because it will immediately get turned into the next intermediate and so on through the cycle. But you have to have ribulose bisphosphate to receive incoming CO2 in order for this cycle to operate. What you see by the boxes is that the overall Calvin cycle occurs in 3 major phases. Carbon fixation is phase 1, because that's when the inorganic source of carbon, in the form of carbon dioxide, gets incorporated into an organic molecule. This 6-carbon short-lived intermediate is organic. So carbon fixation has already happened here, right at the beginning. Then you have a reduction phase after that. Not all the steps are shown here. There's several different reactions in the cycle. But reduction here refers not to taxis, which it was for the in the previous chapter, right? We oxidized the fuel so that we could reduce the taxis, and they were then carrying the energy away. Here, the taxis are being oxidized, and they're reducing the intermediates. Just the opposite is happening. So when it says reduction, what's being reduced are these intermediates in the cycle, not the taxis. The taxis are becoming oxidized. But reducing the intermediates energizes them and allows them to follow through, and every once in a while, off will come a three carbon G3P molecule, the goal. Okay, that's the output. Phase three, though, is regeneration of the CO2 acceptor. Well, the thing that is called the CO2 acceptor is specifically ribulose bisphosphate. I said you have to have that in order to receive more CO2 and keep this going. All right? Those are the three phases. And notice that 6 ATP here, 3 ATP here, that's 9 ATP are required, and 6 NADPHs are required. That's what I meant by the 3 to 2 ratio. If you give it equal amounts of both, it's not the right ratio. That's why you have to switch back and forth between cyclic and non-cyclic flow. Okay, now, the ribulose bisphosphate is the CO2 acceptor. It can receive CO2 and wants to, in a sense, or the plant wants it to happen that way. But it shouldn't surprise you that an enzyme is involved. Actually, there's an enzyme involved in every step. They're just not shown here. This is an especially important enzyme at the top, though, because it catalyzes the fixation of carbon into adding it to ribulose bisphosphate to make this short-lived intermediate. And that special enzyme in the lavender box is Rubisco, which is just an abbreviation, really. It's an acronym, which is why I prefer to write it as capital R-U, capital B, I-S, capital C, capital O. Because its real name that Rubisco is short for is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. So if we write that out, the name itself, rather than Rubisco, the full name, should tell you that this is an enzyme, right? The ASE ending's here. As a matter of fact, it's actually two enzymes in one. It can it's the same molecule, but it can operate in two different ways. Carboxylases, that's a category of enzymes, are enzymes that accomplish carboxylation, which is just the exact opposite of decarboxylation. Remember, in the first part of cellular respiration, which is called the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, we removed a carboxyl, and that's why CO2 came out. Carboxylation is exactly the opposite. You add CO2 to something. That's what's happening. And so Rubisco is a carboxylase, but it can also operate as an oxygenase. Oxygenation is adding oxygen instead of CO2. Well, that is something the plant does not want to happen, or the photosynthetic organism in general, but we're studying plants, because there's a couple problems with this. If oxygen gets added to ribulose bisphosphate instead of CO2, then, of course, you're not fixing any carbon, for one thing, and therefore you're not going to be able to go through the cycle and produce sugar, which is the goal. That's bad enough. But also, not only that, when you add oxygen to ribulose bisphosphate, you make something that can't go through this cycle. And therefore, you have to then spend energy and time getting rid of that oxygen to transform it back into ribulose bisphosphate and give it another try, and hopefully this time it will receive CO2 instead. That is very costly in time and energy to the plant. If it happens, though, which it does pretty often, by it happening, I mean having oxygen come in instead of CO2, that is called photorespiration. And it's just a total waste for the plant. It not only doesn't produce sugars, but it costs energy. Well, the reason it happens so often is because Rubisco is both a carboxylase and an oxygenase, so either one of these two molecules will work. And even worse for the plant is the fact that Rubisco has actually a higher affinity for oxygen than it does for CO2. So if both of these molecules are present, as they are in air, then usually oxygen will win out. And photorespiration will occur, and the plant has to spend time and energy undoing that. Okay? Well, that's just something that most plants have to live with. A high error rate, in so to speak, or high inefficiency. Plants that just have to put up with this are called C3 plants. But evolution has occurred in certain groups of plants, two major groups of plants, that have evolved ways around this photorespiration problem. And the way to solve the problem is to separate two processes. Separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle. In a C3 plant, carbon fixation is part of the Calvin cycle, so it's not separated. Okay? Let's take a look at these two categories of plants, starting with 17, which shows you a C4 plant. C4 plants is one group that have evolved a solution to the problem. Now, all the plants that have evolved a solution are separating carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle, but there's two ways that this can be accomplished. C4 plants accomplish it by separating these two things into different spaces. When I explain a normal leaf anatomy, I was talking about a C3 plant at the time, even though I didn't call it a C3 plant. When I was talking about the sandwich arrangement, and the filling of the sandwich is mesophyll cells. Well, in a C4 plant, there are mesophyll cells, but in addition to those, there are also specialized cells that are deeper into the interior, away from the atmosphere, compared to the mesophyll cells, and those are called bundle sheath cells. Okay? We have one of each shown here on the right in detail. This mesophyll cell operates first, and it's the one that is more superficial, which means it's closer to the atmosphere, it's closer to the surface of the leaf, which is, of course, where the oxygen is. Okay? What happens here is that a preliminary cycle operates in a C4 plant in the mesophyll cell. This is not the Calvin cycle. This is a separate cycle catalyzed by a different enzyme, not Rubisco, but PEP carboxylase. PEP, you don't have to know, but it stands for phosphoenolpyruvate carboxylase. Well, it is a carboxylase like Rubisco is, but it is not also an oxygenase. And therefore, if oxygen is here, which it will be because this is right next to the air, the oxygen doesn't interfere with the problem. The only thing that will work with PEP carboxylase is CO2, which is exactly what the plant wants to come in only, right? CO2. So that's where carbon fixation takes place, because the CO2 is the inorganic carbon. It's being incorporated into an organic compound in this preliminary cycle. Well, when you go through the intermediates of this cycle, it also involves transport of these intermediates through plasmodesmata to these deeper cells called bundle sheath cells. And the carbon that is part of the intermediates, but it used to be in the CO2, then gets released. That's why a CO2 is coming off here. And that CO2 then goes to the Calvin cycle occurring in this deeper bundle sheath cell. The Calvin cycle is using Rubisco here, but it's not as affected by O2 because O2 is out in the atmosphere, not deeper in the leaf. So it's much more efficient than a C3 plant. Okay? But notice that the separation of the two processes, carbon fixation and the Calvin cycle, in a C4 plant occurs spatially. It's a spatial separation, meaning each of them is occurring in its own compartment. Well, a C4 plan is shown in 18 as well on the left side. We just went over this. It's a spatial separation of the two processes. A different group of plants solved the problem by separating the two processes, but not in space. They separated them in time. It's a temporal separation. Temporal means in time. And these plants are called CAM plants, all caps, because it's an acronym. CAM stands for crassulation acid metabolism, which is a weird word, crassulation. Probably you've never heard of it, but that's simply the name of the group of plants in which this was discovered. Now, they're not the only ones capable of this, but because that's what it was discovered in, all plants that are able to do this are called CAM plants. Same thing's happening here, but in one cell, just the two processes occur at different times. In a CAM plant, during the day, when the light is shining, of course, the stomata, which are the little openings in the leaves, are closed. Most plants have them open during the day because when the sun is shining, that's when they need the CO2 for that the light-dependent reactions is allowing to be incorporated, right? But not in a CAM plant. They close down during the day. They open up at night. Now, there's no light-dependent reactions occurring at night, of course, but other things are going on in a CAM plant. So they're open at night, which is when the CO2 is allowed in, and the CO2 gets incorporated into an organic acid in this first cycle. Just gradually overnight, more and more CO2 comes in and gets incorporated into more and more organic acids. That's why it's called acid metabolism. The acids that are accumulated overnight are really just a way of storing the carbon dioxide temporarily. Right? The Calvin cycle is not operating at night because without the light, you don't have the ATP and the NADPH being created. So it's shut down at night. Next morning, they close back down. By the way, that has the advantage, since these tend to grow in very hot environments, has the advantage of reducing the amount of water that they lose by evaporation. Most plants have to remain open to get CO2 in, but they have no choice but to lose water as well. But anyway, the next day when the sun is shining, they close down. That prevents oxygen from coming in, which would interfere with the Calvin cycle, right? And even though no CO2 is coming in, they have a bunch of this stored organic acid, which then gets decarboxylated. It releases the CO2 that it stored, and that feeds the Calvin cycle during the day when the NADPH and ATP are being made by the light-dependent reactions. That all makes sense? So they solved it really the same way, just in two methods, temporal separation versus spatial separation. Well, I've given you all the information. 19 is really just a summary slide, so it's worth going over this. Remember that compared to the complete oxidation of glucose, photosynthesis does not occur in different parts of the cell. There's no cytosolic component like there was for glycolysis. Instead, the entire photosynthetic process occurs within a chloroplast, if we're talking about a eukaryotic organism, which we are here. That's why it's all inside a chloroplast here. There's two major components, the light-dependent reactions and the light-independent reactions. The light-independent reactions are the part that accomplish carbon fixation. That's why CO2, inorganic carbon source, is coming in, and that produces sugar. Now, sucrose here is just an example. It directly produces G3P, like I said, and then that gets incorporated into other things. Doing that, of course, is endergonic and anabolic, because you're making a complex thing out of smaller things. It's therefore expensive, endergonic, which is why it requires energy. But it can't be light directly that's powering this. That's why you need the energetic middlemen here, ATP and NADPH, which are created in the light-dependent reactions only if light is shining. The light energy is captured, and that energy, the part that's not lost as heat, allows for the production of ATP and NADPH that power the Calvin cycle's operation. But when the Calvin cycle uses these energy-carrying molecules, it turns them into their lower energy counterparts, right? NADPH gets reoxidized into NADP+, ATP gets dephosphorylated into ADP. Those then have to ride back to the light-dependent reactions to get recharged with energy over and over, only if light continues to shine. What I didn't mention is that the light-dependent reactions, in addition to having the non-material input of light energy, have the material input of water. And as I said earlier, water really is just a source of electrons and protons of the hydrogens that are in that water, which is why when that hydrogen gets removed from water, an output is oxygen. Oxygen is, from the viewpoint of photosynthesis, just a waste product, like CO2 was for the previous chapter. Just never lose track of the fact that a plant has a chloroplast and a mitochondrion. So the O2 that's produced here as a waste product can be valuable stuff for the reciprocal process that it's also able to do in the mitochondrion. And the CO2 that's produced by a mitochondrion can feed the photosynthesis part of it. So it has the reciprocity all built into the same organism. All right, any questions? Everyone agree with that? Okay, then I'll see you in the laboratory.